If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
At this time on Wednesday, Anna DeVlantis joins us for This Week in Chicago History. Good morning, Anna.
Good morning, Bob.
Let's start by remembering This Week in 1993, a sweet moment for sweetness.
Oh, no doubt. No question about it. This was a moving moment for Bears fans everywhere, Bob, when Walter Payton was inducted into the NFL Hall of Fame in Canton, Ohio, This Week, 1993. Payton had retired just 6 years prior, and that moment was one of the proudest moments in his career, his family said. We didn't know it then, but Walter would just have 6 more years to live tragically after that. And in his emotional speech, you know, some people will recall he referenced how life is short. Amazingly, he expressed deep appreciation for those who came before. He was humble. He expressed his love for fans, those who helped him along the way. And he gave a special nod to his family, Bob. Son Jarrett Payton, you'll probably recall this moment. He was just 12 years old, and he took to the podium to talk about his dad in a powerful speech that brought the crowd to their feet. It was the first time at that point in NFL history that a son had been chosen as the presenter for the induction. And here's Walter Payton at the podium. We pulled a clip of him expressing his love for his family and his gratitude for an incredible NFL career. It'll take you back.
Great to hear him again. I always smile because he was a guest of ours on Fox Thing in the Morning, and we had him in bed, and he didn't stop laughing for the whole segment. He was so much fun. We miss him.
I remember that segment, the in bed with.
Yeah. The eight man out this week in 1921, the Black Sox.
Okay, this is an interesting one to remember because we all remember 1919 when they were charged with throwing the World Series, and that's when the World Series happened. But 2 years later, Bob, 1921 was a big one for the Chicago Black Sox, and this week was one of the biggest ones of their lives. The eight White Sox players who were in court, they learned their fate in court. A full 2 years after that infamous World Series, it all came down to a verdict that shocked the nation, really, despite bringing shame to themselves, to the White Sox, to the game of baseball, being charged with accepting bribes to throw the World Series. The players were all acquitted in court this week in 1921, found not guilty after the jury deliberated for just 2 hours and 47 minutes. After that verdict, there was some public sentiment shifting in favor of the players, and it led to a fierce public battle between the players and Charlie Comiskey, the owner of the Sox, including a highly covered, publicized court battle involving shoeless Joe Jackson, who boldly sued Comiskey after being vindicated. We pulled this dramatic clip from an ESPN documentary. I think you'll appreciate, Bob. It's on the Black Sox, and we pick it up at the point when Joe Jackson was engaged in a lawsuit with Charlie Comiskey.
That was the voice of the great sports writer, the Dean, Jerry Holtzman.
Yeah. How about that, though? The missing grand jury document shows up in Comiskey's lawyer's briefcase. And I mean, just the Cook County antics and all that. But, you know, interesting because they never really regained their honor, as you know, and never played professional baseball again. But that little twist, often forgotten moment in history.
Yeah, they didn't think they would get caught. Janis Joplin. And this is really amazing. We go back to the summer of 1970 and Janis running into the law at Ravinia, no less, huh?
I know. Ravinia, not exactly the place where you see a lot of concerts go out of control or mosh pits or anything like that. Doesn't usually happen, but back in 1970, Janis Joplin, fresh off her Woodstock appearance the summer before, Bob, came to Ravinia, and the authorities were super concerned about what might happen, what kind of craziness might break out. And her appearance prompted the largest police presence anyone had seen in a long time. They thought the young hippie crowd would just get out of control. I'm not sure what they thought they would do, but they sent in 200 police officers from Highland Park and surrounding communities just in case. 27-year-old Janis Joplin had teamed up with the Full Tilt Boogie Band on the evening of August 5th, 1970 at Ravinia, surrounded by police. And the Tribune, it's interesting to look and see how they reported at the time, saying a mob of 20,000 clapping, screaming fans were dancing erratically, making police and security nervous. I don't know, Bob, that doesn't seem like that sounds too crazy. Well, you weren't in that crowd by any chance, were you, Bob? No. Weren't you one of those crazy, erratic dancers or anything?
No, not me. I don't know what I was doing, but I wasn't there. I wish I would have been there to see Janis Joplin at Ravinia.
Right. Great. Think about that. And so you just wonder how the crowds then compare to your typical Lollapalooza crowds today, and if there's really that much difference.
Yeah, I'm
but
sure.
Anyway,
I'm sure when they walked around with those signs asking people to be quiet, the kids calm down immediately.
They calm down.
Yeah.
I'm sure. That's all it takes, Bob. It's really simple. But there really weren't any antics at the end of the day. And even though, you know, they were worried about it, it was just a great concert. And people had an awesome time, and there were no arrests. So it was kind of, you know, as advertised, a Janis Joplin concert.
This week in 1967, Second City opened its doors. Tell us about this.
The beautiful theater, and the amazing theater that over the years has just come to exemplify the top improv acts in the world, some of the best talent in the world. It opened its theater space on Wells, this week, 1967, Bob. Moving in there from a temporary space, there was an old laundromat. That's where Joan Rivers and Alan Arkin and director Mike Nichols cut their teeth on improv. But then when they moved into the new space, there at 1616 Wells, it was a real theater with big dreams of, expansion, and they were trying to find the best talent. And who walked in the door not long after was Harold Ramis, local Chicago Public Schools grad who was doing comedic writing at the time. And he had this huge impact on Second City that went beyond his performances because he was a tremendous writer and he knew how to bring out the best of the talent around him. And there was a lot of talent around him, of course, Bill Murray, John Belushi, among them. Ramis said he became really good at putting himself next to the most talented people in the room. These are skills he perfected at Second City and then launched a hugely successful Hollywood career. Here's more from him.
I miss Harold. What a great guy and a great talent.
Such a talent, right? Caddyshack, Ghostbusters, Stripes, Groundhog Day. I mean, it goes on and on. Just an incredible man and incredible talent.
And finally, we have the story of a beer that, you know the slogan, but it was controversial, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, Bob, 1893, go back to the World's Fair, and Pabst Blue Ribbon wasn't called Pabst Blue Ribbon at that time. It was Pabst Best Select. They became Pabst Blue Ribbon because they won an award, a blue ribbon at the Chicago World's Fair, which was a huge deal. They were awarding these very selectively for best in class inventions and things that they had seen across the fair. But researchers over time have kind of questioned whether or not they really want a blue ribbon. And they're saying that this might have been just kind of an elaborate marketing scheme to help boost the brand. It's interesting because Pabst Blue Ribbon became a huge success story, really because of on the backs of marketing it as an award-winning beer. People loved it. You still see it outside taverns all across Chicago. You see the big Pabst Blue Ribbon sign everywhere. Back in the day, coming out of the fair, Bob, they even tied a silk blue ribbon around every single bottle to market it. But over the years, the researchers who've looked into this said, well, we're not sure they actually won a ribbon, but it didn't seem to matter. We pulled an early TV ad for PBR, one that aired in the Chicago area, Bob, and it touted what else but the multitude of awards the beer had won all around the world.
Pabst's fake blue ribbon beer.
It's just amazing how they used to advertise beer back then. That's changed a bit over time, too, hasn't it, Bob?
Just a little bit. Anna DeVlantis, This Week in Chicago History. Talk to you next week. Thanks, Anna.
Talk to you then, Bob.